Well, today we're going to have a look at the Angulimala Sutta, a very famous discourse about the serial killer who was converted by the Buddha. And the main purpose of studying these suttas is because it gives you one up over the Christians. Okay? Because Jesus spoke to prostitutes and so did the Buddha. Jesus spoke to tax collectors and so did the Buddha, but Jesus never converted a serial killer. So that proves that the Buddha was better than Jesus, hence the main purpose of studying this particular sutta. Okay, so trying to retain a little bit of sensibility for the rest of it, starting out with maximum non-political correctness. Here we go. Oh, no, here we go. I'm going to mark that. So here we have the correspondences, which as you can see are quite extensive, as listed on central.net. We not only have the Pali version in the Majjhima Nikaya, we also have a Chinese version in the Sanyukta Agama, of the Sarvastivadin school, a also another version in the shorter Sanyukta Agama, SA2, being a partial translation of a text in Chinese, two independent sutras in the Chinese translation, as well as a version in the Akotara Agama, possibly of the Mahasanghika school, and another two further individual translations in T200 and T212, as well as substantial Sanskrit fragments. The details here, some of the Sanskrit fragments from the Sanyukta Agama in the Sarvastivadin literature, others not identified here, but from Turupam. Okay, now in addition to all of those, we also have the a Tibetan version of it, as listed here. Now, this is still partial, as this little footnote says here. The another footnote gives various Mahayana discourses, both in Chinese and Tibetan, which are of the Tathagata Garbha type and therefore fall outside the scope of our presentation. So that's outside the scope of Sutta Central as such, which encompasses most of the early texts, but this being such a popular story, found its way even into these Tathagata Garbha Mahayana texts, which is of a later strand of Mahayana texts. Now, so obviously, when we see a discourse so widely spread, then that tells us that it was very popular. And obviously being a story of the conversion of a serial killer is a fertile ground for storytelling. Now, in fact, the versions that we have here are in themselves only a partial representation of the Buddhist tradition on this particular story. Within the Pali tradition itself, we've only listed the Majjhima Nikaya here, but Angulimala himself has a series of verses in the Theragata, which relate his version of some of these events and reflections on them. And this sutta, as well as the Theragata verses, also have their own commentary. And in addition, the event is depicted in the Vinaya, and certainly in the Pali Vinaya, and I would guess probably in several other Vinayas as well. And there are various commentaries to all of those texts. So the literature is actually quite vast and quite complex on all of these, and as well as all those, we also find mentions in other miscellaneous-style texts. For example, Xuanzang tells a version of the Angulimala story in his account of his travels in India. And that probably being a version which he was told, so a version from the oral tradition rather than specifically from any one particular textual source. So this sutta is very, the story has been very fertile and has obviously made a great impression for Buddhists and Buddhist storytellers because of the dramatic nature of the story. Now, of course, when we have a proliferation of different versions like this, one of the most obvious things we find is that they all disagree with each other. And if we were to list and make note of all the differences between all the versions, we would take quite a long time. We won't even try to do that. We will note some important differences, and even that's going to take us quite a bit of time. But one thing which I'd like to mention right away is that there's a considerable question mark over the very nature of Angulimala, who he was and what he was doing. We'll see, as usual, that the Pali text gives us a fairly bare bones of a story, although even in the Pali text it's already quite developed and inflated form of narrative. But the that situation is taken to extremes in different kinds of versions of the story. Now, the actual basic premise of it is that Angulimala was a Brahmin student who, for one reason or another, most likely because of the jealousy, he was in love with his teacher's wife, and was then asked to go and kill these people and hang their fingers around his neck. And there's very many textual problems with this whole idea, and Venerable Analia notes a number of the problems with the narrative as we go along. And indeed, the whole idea of it is kind of weird. Okay, I mean, if he's just a brigand, as the Pali discourse has him, then why is he hanging fingers around his neck? If he's a Brahmin student, that whole story becomes very kind of weird. Richard Gombrich came up with a completely new hypothesis, which was that he was actually a Shaivite ascetic, who would be killing people and decorating his body with his body parts. And Richard Gombrich developed that idea in quite some detail in his book, How Buddhism Began, which was published about 10 years ago. We have a copy of it here. And a very interesting book and quite, I think, has some quite important discussions on some different issues relating to early Buddhist scriptures. Gombrich only bases himself on the Pali sources. And his findings have been contested by other scholars, but personally I find them to be fairly interesting, the matter is not provable one way or another, but I do think that the idea is the idea that it was somehow a religious practice of what Angulimala was involved in does kind of tend to explain some of what appear to be the more irrational elements in the story. But I just mention these things for you in advance so that we can think about this as we're going through and can have a look at what we think the most plausible reading of the text might be. So as usual, we'll read primarily from the Bhikkhu Bodhi's translation of the Pali text. Thus have I heard. On one occasion, the Blessed One was living at Savatthi in Jetta's Grove in Atapindika's park. Now, on that occasion, there was a bandit in the realm of King Pasenadi of Kosala named Angulimala, who was merciless, bloody-handed, given to blows and violence, merciless to living beings. Villages, towns, and districts were laid waste by him. He was constantly murdering people, and he wore their fingers as a garland. Okay, so that's a fairly dramatic opening paragraph here. Not quite like the usual one, where as we're discussing, like the Buddha decides to go for alms and then figures it's a bit early to go for alms, or the monks are sitting around having a discussion in the hall, or the Buddha's sitting in meditation. So we don't have these normal kind of peaceful and gentle environments, but a very violent one. Now, there's a number of problems even with that particular account. A bandit, okay. fine. You can understand, well, there's a thug or whatever in the realm, it's causing problems. Villages, towns, and districts were laid waste by him. That's a bit kind of, it's a lot, isn't it? Yeah. For one bandit, no doubt could have been, you know, if he'd been attributed to a number of murders or something like that, would have been more plausible, but to lay waste, when it says laid waste to them, the literal Pali here is by him, villages were made into not villages, towns were made into not towns, districts were made into not districts, okay, or countries were made into not countries. So he's got one man force of destruction, which, he was constantly murdering people and he wore their fingers as a garland. And then you go kind of immediately, sort of, why is he doing that? I mean, he's not just a thief who's you know, plundering some things from people. Why is he sort of driven to murder so many people? And so the Buddhist traditions give various explanations for this rather puzzling little problem. And so I'll just pop over to Venerable Anālio's essay and see what he has to say on this matter. Angulimala Sutta has five Chinese parallels which you've gone through. Past also preserved in Sanskrit fragments, also the Chinese Udana Varga, which is a Dhammapada type text with these stories as well. And also found in a collection of Buddhist tales, which is in Chinese and Tibetan, and the basis for the composition of a Mahayana Sutra. Okay. Angulimala and its Chinese parallels report that when the Buddha went towards Angulimala's horns, onlookers warned him not to proceed further. Oh, I haven't got up to that bit. Okay, we might just read a bit further in the sutta before going on to discuss that. Then when it was morning, the Blessed One dressed and taking his bowl and outer robe went into Savatthi for alms. When he'd wandered for alms in Savatthi and had returned from his alms round after his meal, he set his resting place in order and taking his bowl and outer robe set out on the road leading towards Angulimala. Cowherds, shepherds, ploughmen and travellers saw the Blessed One walking along the road leading towards Angulimala and told him, "Do not take this road, recluse. On this road is the bandit Angulimala, who is murderous, bloody-handed, given to blows and violence, merciless to living beings. Towns, villages, towns and districts have been laid waste by him. He is constantly murdering people and he wears their fingers as a garland. Men have come along this road in groups of 10, 20, 30, even 40, but still they've fallen into Angulimala's hands." When this was said, the Blessed One went on in silence, and for a second time and a third time they said that, but still the Blessed One went on in silence. And so we set up a very dramatic encounter here, the Buddha walking, apparently, to his death. Okay, here we go. The Angulimala. Sutta and its Chinese parallels report that when the Buddha went towards Angulimala's haunts, onlookers warned him not to proceed further. In the two Sangyukta Agama versions, these onlookers informed the Buddha of the presence of a dangerous brigand by the name of Angulimala. Okay, and that's all. The other versions present the threat posed by Angulimala in increasingly stronger degrees. According to the Pali version, there was 40 men had been overpowered by Angulimala. According to the Ekhotra Agama version, it was 50 men. One individual translation says even 100 men would not dare to oppose him, and according to the other individual translation, even up to 1,000 men had been caught by Angulimala. Okay, so here we have the whole kind of spectrum between not mentioning any men being overpowered by him, up from 40, 50, 100, and to 1,000. And Venerable Anālio said these differences reveal a certain tendency to exaggeration, a tendency that makes itself felt again and again in the various versions of the Angulimala Sutta. It's already difficult to believe that a single person would be able to overpower a group of 40 or 50, man, but to be able to do so when faced with 1,000 men is a sheer impossibility. And so here, just to sort of make a note on method here, what now you're doing, of course, is as an academic and as a scholar, he's applying a standard of rational plausibility to the narrative. Is it plausible that someone should overpower 40 or 50 men? Well, highly unplausible. Is it plausible that he should overpower 1,000 men? Obviously, it's completely impossible. And in a sense, this is judging or treating the narrative in terms of a historical story or a journalistic account. It's like, you know, if we were to read this in the paper and it said that one man overpowered 40 or 50 men, how would we respond to that? So what we're seeing here with the text is that process, and this is why it's very interesting to be able to look at the different versions and to see these differences. And so what you're seeing is the evolution of that text from becoming a mere report of some events that happened into becoming a myth. And so the idea of one individual getting into a fight and overpowering countless foes is, of course, standard in any kind of hero mythology. And you find that still today in just about any action movie or something like that, is that the hero, through their whatever it is, special abilities or special technology or whatever it is able to take on and overpower in incredible odds. And so here we're seeing just an early version of exactly that same kind of tendency. So this is just to reflect that there are two different ways, at least two different ways of reading it. One is the empirical way or analytical way, which Analio is using, which assumes that things would have been more or less realistic and more or less similar to how they are today, and that things then can be judged by standards, rational standards we can derive from our experience today. So it puts it into a historical context. The other way of looking at it in a mythic context is that it's outside of time and place, that the idea of one person overpowering 1,000 is not meant to represent a historical fact, but is meant to give us an idea, an emotional response to the level of violence and strength and so on which is involved here, and correspondingly the power of the conversion which happens at the end. So the two Samyukta argument discourses begin directly with the Buddha on his way towards Angulimala. The Pali discourse and the other Chinese version precede this with an introductory account. As part of the introductory account, the Pali discourse, a Ekkhasara Agama version, and one of the individual translations indicate that Angulimala wore the fingers of his victims as a garland. That's why it's called Angulimala. One of the individual translations said that Angulimala caused harm to villages and towns. The Pali version goes further, saying that he laid waste to villages and towns and even whole districts. The commentary explains that people had deserted their homes and fled to Savatthi because they were afraid of Angulimala. Although the abandonment of a village in the vicinity of Angulimala's murderous activity seems conceivable, one might wonder how a single robber could cause whole districts to be left deserted. In a predominantly agricultural society, such a mass exodus would imply loss of livelihood for a considerable part of the population and thus be quite a dramatic decision. I think we even need to, whatever kind of society, agricultural or any other, it's still fairly extreme. The Pali version's suggestion that whole districts had been laid waste stands, moreover, in contrast to the circumstance that cowards, shepherds and ploughmen warned the Buddha of Angulimala. And so their very presence in close proximity suggests that the area of his activities was not as abandoned as the Pali version's description suggests. Yeah, well, they were abandoning it, but in any case, I think the point is clear enough. As part of the introduction to the meeting between the Buddha and the Angulimala, Ekkhasara Agama discourse and the two individual translations indicate that a group of monks had gone into town and witnessed a great crowd complaining to the king and demanding that action should be taken against the brigand. The Pali version also records such a complaint made about Angulimala to the king. although the excursion occurs at a later point in the narration by way of introduction to King Pasenadi's visit to the Buddha. According to the three Chinese versions, when the monks reported that they'd seen the Buddha, he'd reacted by leaving for Angulimala's haunts, since in these versions the Buddha appears to have approached Angulimala in order to prevent him from being caught by the king. Okay, so as we've seen in our version, there's no particular motivation for the Buddha. He just gets up and goes there. And just also just to see one of the interesting thing about this is how these stories include similar elements which are included and combined in all kinds of different ways. And it's quite fascinating how ideas and motifs which are not present in the early versions of the sutta nevertheless are common among the Buddhist traditions and are common in the later tellings from, say, Sri Lanka through to central India up to Kashmir and so on, where the Sarvastivada versions come from. And so there's a presence within the Buddhist culture where stories were shared among the culture, even though they were not found in the canonical texts as such. And so always to remember when we're considering the Pali Canon and the canonical scriptures themselves, that they have always constituted only a part of the actual culture of Buddhism and the scriptures and teachings and texts of Buddhism. Okay. Okay, so we've just come we've reached in the sutta to the place where the Buddha actually meets Angulimala, but here, one of the individual translations goes on to the origin story, how it is that Angulimala actually became a killer in the first place. So this account found in one of the individual translations resembles in several respects the story found in the Pali commentary. And again, just to notice this, that we have a commentarial version down in Sri Lanka, this individual text deriving from somewhere in the north of India, and yet sharing similar story, although not identical. According to this individual translation, Angulimala had been an extraordinarily strong, intelligent, and beautiful young Brahman. The wife of his teacher had fallen in love with him. He, however, refused to comply with her wishes. Enraged, she pretended to her husband that Angulimala had forcefully tried to seduce her. Out of fear of Angulimala's strength, the teacher did not dare to punish him directly, and thus devised the idea to command Angulimala to procure the fingers obtained by killing 100 victims within a single day, hoping that this would lead Angulimala to be reborn in hell. Okay, so this is one version of the traditional explanation of how Angulimala got to be abandoned. Now, of course, raises many questions. The background of the story, the fact that the woman falls in love with him, he rejects her, and then she slanders him, and so on. That, of course, is a pretty kind of stock structure in story construction, and could have been derived from any number of tales and so on. But the bit where the teacher did not dare to punish him directly because he was so strong, and thus devised the idea to command Angulimala to procure the fingers obtained by killing 100 victims within a single day. Seems a bit kind of weird, isn't it? It doesn't follow automatically on from thinking that someone's tried to have a go with your wife, and you automatically think, I'm going to command him to go out and kill 100 people, so then he's going to go to hell. Okay, I didn't know. Oh, I should have a look at that. Maybe there are some parallels there. Anyway, that's interesting. There certainly is parallels to this idea of wanting to get rid of someone, a rival or someone, by setting an impossible task for them. That's quite a common trope in mythology. Like for example, Jason in the Golden Fleece was one of that In that case, he was like destined to become the next king or something, so the king who was in power wanted to get rid of him and told him to go on a quest, which he thought he'd never come back from. So that in itself is fairly common, but yeah.
Well, they're certainly part of a common tradition. So they're part of a shared storytelling tradition in the Buddhist culture, which could have been derived from an early stage, or it could have been something which was developed and shared later among the tradition. Quite possibly a bit of both. You know, I think that the story, the kernel of the story was probably there from the beginning and then evolved and changed and so on, but also probably fed back and forth among each other. Exactly, yeah. Exactly, yeah. Because, you know, you can imagine this was the kind of thing that would be told, you know, as a popular sermon and things like that, be repeated. And, you know, always trying to liven it up, put some new spin on it, make it more vivid, more dramatic. So, yeah, but that kind of nexus, or that between the problem of supposedly the woman who's been refused, sort of getting revenge, and then the result of it. This is one of the problematic details of the narrative. Chinese Udanavarga is similar, except mentions 1,000 victims to be killed, a number also mentioned in the Akota Agama version and the Pali commentary. The Pali commentarial tradition differs from the individual translation in Chinese Udanavarga insofar as it attributes Angulimala's defamation to jealous fellow students. The commentary to the Angulimala Theragata agrees with the individual translation that out of fear of Angulimala's strength, the teacher did not try to kill him. According to the Majjhima Nikaya commentary, however, the teacher desisted from killing Angulimala in order not to lose his reputation as a teacher. So here we see the proliferation of these different kind of details. And of course, both commentaries indicate that already at Angulimala's birth, it had become clear that he was destined to become a brigand, thereby presenting him in a less favorable light than the individual translation and the Chinese Udanavarga. So a lot of these things are actually motifs from the hero's journey. Okay, so the idea of the destiny from birth and so on and so forth. So even though he's a dark hero, but he's still nevertheless a hero. For example, the motif of the refusing the woman's advances is found already in Gilgamesh, and the revenge that she wreaks on him being the spur for his greatest heroic activity. That's also found in Gilgamesh. Okay. Okay, the Majjhima Nikaya commentary explains that Angulimala decided to wear the fingers as a garland in order to keep count of his victims. Okay, so here being another little problem at, we actually got like 10 fingers each. Right, so one might have decided to choose a nose or something like that to be rather more efficient in doing that. But also, like, why you actually wear it? You know, you can surely make a notch on a tree or something like that if you want to keep count of your victim. Again, this. Sorry. No. Yeah, that's true. But he quite likely one of those things. What they want to do is to also if that's the proof for that he's actually done it. Like if you're a hunter or something, you bring back the pelt so you can prove how many you've killed. Yeah. No, but if he wants to prove to his teacher how many he's killed. Yeah. And you might not necessarily kill anyone, actually. You might just chop off a lot of fingers. Anyway, it seems it's another thing where if he wanted to keep count of his victims, he could have just made a notch on a tree or whatever. Anyway. Or like, whatever. It's kind of like, kind of fingers.
According to the Kotra Agama version, blah, 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 the individual translation, Udanavarga account is teacher instructed him to make a garland out of the fingers of his victims. Whatever may have been the rationale for constructing such a garland, it would have been impossible to wear. And Analia very helpfully proving that it's doing the math for us, 1,000 fingers, you can't wear it, okay? The imagery, it's better not taken too literally. Yeah, and so some of them say he was wearing it on the forehead, and sometimes it suggests that it's a hairdress or decoration and not a necklace, and so on, so whether it was a necklace or whatever. The idea that he needed 1,000, according to Gombrich, must have arisen from an over-literal interpretation of a passage found in the Angulimala Terigata. Terigata, having heard your verse connected with the Dhamma, I will abandon 1,000 evils, Sahasapapa. So this is this kind of Gombrich's suggestion there. Commentary reports that when a great crowd complained to the king about Angulimala's murderous activities, Angulimala's father realized that this robber must be his son. Angulimala's mother therefore decided to approach her son and fetch him before the king would catch him. In order to prevent Angulimala from killing his own mother, the Buddha decided to approach Angulimala himself. So of course the mother, Angulimala's mother also takes part in the Ekotra Agama version, in one of the individual translations, and in the Chinese Udanavarga. According to these three versions, however, his mother had come to bring him some food. As Angulimala lacked only one more finger to make up the number of victims required, he decided to kill his mother. The individual translation explains his willingness to kill his own mother by the circumstance that the sun was about to set, and his teacher had requested him to accomplish his murderous feat within a single day. And then the Ankotra Agama discourse and the individual translation narrate that Angulimala had already gotten hold of his mother when the Buddha intervened in order to prevent Angulimala from committing this abominable crime. According to the individual translation, the Buddha suddenly appeared in front of Angulimala, while according to the Ankotra Agama report, the Buddha emanated a great light that illuminated the whole forest. Ekotra Agama account narrates that Angulimala was alarmed by this great light and asked his mother to explain what was taking place. She replied in a set of verses telling him that the source of this light could only be the Buddha. When Angulimala heard this, he was full of joy, as the teacher told him that by killing his mother or the Buddha, he would be reborn in heaven. Okay? He told his mother to wait for a minute, as he would just kill the Buddha and then come back and have the meal she brought for him. I think so, yes. That's absolutely, yeah. not to blindly accept everything, yes. This is Ekotra Agama. We've got a moment. So we have the actual verses of the mother. Blah, blah. So, Xuanzang was also, the version by Xuanzang also has Angulimala about to kill his mother and rejoicing. So here the narratives come back together again. So we've had this kind of proliferation of these introduction of all these different kind of ideas, the Brahmanical student, the jealousy, the reasons why he's getting the garland, the introduction of his mother, of course, adding an extra kind of bit of pathos and tension as if the story wasn't dramatic enough already, none of which is found in the actual early text. Okay, so we've left the Buddha walking along in silence, having ignored the warnings. And when the bandit Angulimala saw the Blessed One coming in the distance, he saw him, he thought, it is wonderful, it is marvelous. Men have come along this road in groups of 10, 20, 30, even 40, but still they have fallen into my hands. But now this recluse comes alone and unaccompanied as if forcing his way. Why shouldn't I take this recluse's life? So again, no notion that it's like making up. Huh, interesting. Yeah, I was kind of curious about that little idiom. It doesn't
Yeah, let me just have a look. Yeah, I'm not sure what that is. There's an unusual word here. Atacha, okay, and then but then this panayang, this samana, this monk, alone with no second, pasaiha manye agachati, he comes as if pasaiha, as if he's comes as if one would, manye is an idiom meaning one would imagine that, or as if he's like this, and as if he's pasaiha, but I'm not sure what the word pasaiha is. I guess it's probably a one of these words that only occurs occasionally. So. Removing by force the saiha of spirituous liquor made from rice. Pasahati, gerund from pasahati. Pasahati, pa and sa, to use force, subdue, oppress, overcome. Using force to say her. Okay. So I would guess in that kind of case, it's possible Bhikkhu Bodhi's original one may have been more influenced by the commentary. That's just a guess. And this is more of a literal one, unaccompanied, as if forcing his way. I'm not sure if that captures it. It seems to be as if he is a force, you know, as if he's so strong that nothing I can do is going to hurt him. I think that's possibly the sense that he's coming on. He's completely fearless. But yeah, I'm not 100% sure of that. Okay. Then the Blessed One performed such a feat of supernormal power that the bandit Angulimala, though running as fast as he could not catch up with the Blessed One, who was walking at his normal pace. And the Angulimala thought, "It's wonderful, it's marvelous. Formerly I could catch up even with a swift elephant and seize it. I would catch up even with a swift horse and seize it. I would catch up even with a swift chariot and seize it. I would catch up even with a swift deer and seize it. But now, though I'm running as fast as I can, cannot catch up with this recluse who is walking at his normal pace." He stopped and called out to the Blessed One, "Stop, recluse, stop, recluse. I have stopped, Angulimala. You stop too." Then the bandit Angulimala thought, "These recluses, sons of Sakyam, speak truth. They assert the truth. But though this recluse is still walking, he says, I have stopped. Angulimala, you stop too. Suppose I question this recluse." Yep. And then the verses. "While you're walking, recluse, you tell me you've stopped, but now when I say I've stopped, you say I've not stopped. I ask you now, recluse, about the meaning. How is it that you have stopped and I have not? Angulimala, I have stopped forever. I abstain from violence towards living beings, but you have no restraint towards things that live. That is why I have stopped and you have not." Angulimala says, "Oh, at long last, this recluse, a venerated sage, has come to this great forest for my sake. Having heard your stanza teaching me the Dhamma, I will indeed renounce evil forever." So saying, the bandit took his sword and weapons and flung them in a gaping chasm's pit. The bandit then worshipped the Sublime One's feet and then and there asked for the going forth. The Enlightened One, the sage of great compassion, the teacher of the world with all its gods, addressed him with these words, "Come, Bhikkhu." And that was how he came to be a bhikkhu. And so here, this kind of exchange is not dissimilar to some exchanges that we see between, say, the Buddha and some yakas. I'm thinking, for example, the Alawaka Sutta, with Alawaka the yaka who comes in and threatens and bullies the Buddha and so on, and the Buddha quite rapidly manages to convert him. And so here he's throwing out this kind of riddle. So this is teaching by means of a riddle on its surface. The surface meaning is obviously untrue, and so he's
throws him, it confuses him, and he realizes that he actually must be talking at a different level. And then when the story reaches its climax, and this is really the climax and the crux of the story, the moment of conversion, then it switches over from prose to verse. And this is the way of signifying it, the literary technique that signifies the emotional heightening of that moment. When this was taught in the traditional manner, in the oral tradition, these verses would be sung with a simple melody. And so this is the dramatic high point of the thing. This is what we find again and again when reading, say, the Jataka stories and other kinds of literature. Last night we were discussing about Julian Jain and his theory of various theories of the origin of consciousness, and this was one of his ideas, which was very interesting, was that ancient literature is almost all in verse, and that verse is almost all religious of one kind or another, and it has similar. It has a similar kind of structure. The ancient verse has a similar structure in terms of its rhythms. So you find that they have a similar kind of metrical structure, obviously not identical, but a similar kind of thing occurring widely throughout the world. So Jain postulating whether this has some close relationship with some kind of heightened state of consciousness. The Vedic seers, the composers of the Vedic verses, always claim to be seeing, seers of the verses. It's like through some kind of divine inspiration that the verses are channeled, rather than being something which is sort of composed according to, as ordinary prose might be. So this is why in the Buddhist scriptures, poetry is always the moment of the greatest emotional tension. Okay then. In the sutta, no, that's okay. So this idea that Angulimada had the supporting conditions for arahantship, that is a reference to a very popular notion in the Abhidhamma schools of Theravada, and also kind of other Abhidhamma ideas, which is that when we're born, that we have certain predominant root conditions. So the root conditions are either greed, hatred, and delusion, or absence of greed, hatred, and delusion. And so the idea is that different beings, when they're born, have a predominance of these things, and different predominances, and that affects their spiritual potential. So that this is reference to that idea. And, you know, in a sense, while that way of putting it is from a kind of a later systematization of the idea, but there is sort of valid reasoning from this to thinking he was actually very talented, you know. He seemed to be very intelligent or whatever, very, you know, good. He's good at being bad. Yeah. So, The specific kind of doctrinal thing which is introduced in that idea is the idea that these are part of the relinking conditions at the time of birth. And so rather than being the capacity of a particular individual at a particular time and place. So, you know, again, I'm not saying there's anything wrong with that idea, but just to notice that that's a sort of somewhat developed from the sort of point of view. The whole point of his conversion, I mean, it's quite likely and quite possible that the verses constitute some of the oldest part of the literature. I mean, certainly that's the case in the Jatakas and other, you know, Buddhist forms of Buddhist literature. The verses would have been more or less stuck in time from a fairly early age, and that the prose would develop around that. And so, interesting that in the verses it doesn't really refer to him kind of even murdering people, really. I mean, it just says he's unrestrained towards living beings. Obviously kind of a violent guy. He's got his sword and weapons and so on, but it's even much more stripped back compared to the prose text. And also I find it's interesting how that crux of that and that shift in his consciousness is pivots around a riddle. And there's this kind of riddle or this logical conundrum, which is at the heart of the thing. And again, this is a very, very common trope in all kinds of mythology, from Oedipus to the Hobbit. And it's almost that riddle, and it's also kind of reminiscent of the whole koan kind of tradition, that you're kind of being forced out of a kind of a normal way of thinking. Suddenly he's stopped, he's puzzled, he's got forced out of his black and white thinking. You're either stopped or you're going, but you say you stopped and you're still going. So this is kind of to shift the levels out of his uncertainty.
So just come back to Analia's essay. Okay. Okay, all of the versions agree that Angulimala was unable to catch up with the Buddha, even though the Buddha was walking at a slow pace. The Udana Varga account explains that the Buddha accomplished this feat by magically contracting the earth where Angulimala was and expanding the earth where he was himself. The Pali Discourse and one individual translation say that he was surprised being able to catch up with the Buddha as he could catch an elephant, horse, a chariot. And Analia making the fairly obvious point that whether this is to be taken literally, since it's difficult for a human being to be strong enough to catch an elephant or fast enough to catch up with a horse. Okay, so the different versions present the riddle in different lengths and different numbers of verses and so on.
Like which bits?
That's
Analia who's making those comments. Analia, the contemporary German monk. So this was not from the I mean, I think that's a fair enough remark. I mean, in a sense, that's the method that he's using, and that's the limitation of it. You know, it's not an imaginative engagement with the text as such, and it's fairly limited. That kind of approach is fairly limited in what you can read out of it. It does have, it even has uses just as from a historical and textual point of view, but it also has, it's also, you know, a surprising amount of people will still really insist that these things are all literally exactly true as they happen, so it's kind of useful in that regard. But yeah, I agree with you. And this has been kind of the essence of the critique of this kind of approach, that, yeah, you end up with a deconstructed pile of nothing, really, and that loss of power that it actually has. So, I mean, I think that tells us that this kind of approach doesn't exhaust the text. It doesn't exhaust the kind of ways that we can look at it. Yeah, it's just another way of informing how we should be approaching it. Yeah, definitely. So have a look at this. Here Analia is referring to Gombrich's article, 996, suggested to amend the first line of, this is just one of Gombrich's suggestions, that to amend the first line of Angulimala's verse from Mahesi to Maheso. Mahesi meaning great sage, okay, and Maheso being an epithet, basically a similar kind of word, but being an epithet or an adjective which would be attributed to Shiva. Based on this emendation, he concluded that Angulimala was a proto-Shaiva Shakta, and that his practice of collecting fingers for a necklace is thus sure to be the result of a vow,
in which the worshipper tries to attain the iconic form of his god. All right. Now, Shiva in Indian mythology is, of course, largely linked with these kinds of darker practices, both Shiva and his various female consorts. And you have a very well attested tradition of not just fairly normal things like, say, animal sacrifice and so on, but also some pretty bizarre and extreme practices. Perhaps the best known being the what's known as the thuggies, from where we get the English word thug, and the thuggies being a particular religious cult being devoted to Kali, I believe, or devoted anyway to someone who's seen as being a consort of Shiva, I think it was Kali, and as being a particular caste who would basically abduct people, murder them, and do various kinds of black rituals and so on and so forth. And they were widely feared in regions of India, and the thuggies were eventually hunted down and wiped out by the British. So there's certainly no doubt that there were a lot of very dark practices done under the name of Shiva. And there's also no doubt, it seems, that such things have a long history. Maitri Murthy, in 1998, criticized Gombrich, saying that there seems to be no testimony at all in the history of Indian religions to the practice of killing for decorating oneself with parts of the victim's body. I'm not quite sure what he's referring to there, because it seems to me fairly common kind of thing. I mean, you see this all the way through the Tibetan imagery of people decorated with skulls and bones, and the Shivite aesthetics have bones in their hair and all kinds of things. So that's the kind of question. But I would say definitely yes. Yeah, they wouldn't necessarily kill for the purpose of doing that, but they would kill. And then they would take the victim's bones and wear them. Yeah, that religious iconic, as a religious icon, of course, just a picture, but very often it does reflect actual religious practices. You do find even today in India that there are Shivite ascetics who will carry with them human bones, and who will. It's these kind of very dark kind of ascetics. It's actually a point of pride. Talk about how black their black magic can be. And so they will kind of get, that's how they get fees and support and all of these things, is by claiming to be possessing such dark magic from having done such terrible things. And in many cases it may well be that they're just boasting about it, yeah? But it also is quite, certainly the case in some cases that these things. So, yeah, and again, the idea of decorating yourself with parts of the victim's body, it seems to me a very common practice. I mean, even in the Hebrew scriptures, you find that they do the kind of the animal sacrifices, and then they have to daub themselves with blood and these kinds of things. Yeah, and there's all these instructions, I think, with Abraham or whatever, and he's got to daub blood over the shrine and all these kinds of things as they're burning their flesh. Yeah, it's pretty wild stuff. Yeah. So anyway, this is Maitramurti's objection, explaining that, and Maitramurti explains that by such a proto-Shaiva Shakta would moreover antedate other known practitioners of Shaivic tantrism by a millennium. The emphasis I would put on here is known, and it simply being the fact that these kinds of practices are underground. I mean, it's hard enough to find out evidence of them today, much less how to find evidence of them 2,000 years ago. The blah, blah, blah. Okay, and Alio then goes on to add, so this has been specifically this point of Gombrich's that we should amend the word Mahesi to Maheso, and the Gombrich doesn't use the Chinese text here, and Alio then very helpfully gives a whole range of Chinese translations, meaning sage, such a man, venerable one, great sage, recluse, great sage, and so on. Thus the Chinese versions do not give any support for assuming Angulimala's verse to refer to Shiva. That is as it is. It's not particularly decisive. It's not
clear to me at all that the Chinese translators would have recognized it as a reference to Shiva, even if it was. So just to mention, there is this discussion, the fact that Shaivic tantrism is not attested till much later. Well, you could equally argue that in the Indus Valley, 1,000 years before, you have a picture of what looks like a proto-Shaivic ascetic who's wearing horns on his head. And the horns may well have been quite commonly attested in shamanic cultures and so on, that you will actually wear, they will actually wear horns. They'll actually get their horns from a bull or whatever and put them on their head, you know. Well, he also points to, and there's another verse actually in the Bhikkhuni Terigata of another Bhikkhuni who he claims is also looks like a kind of Kali worshipper who was sort of living in the tunnel ground and doing kind of, you know, this kind of weird and ghoulish kind of stuff with these bones and so on, who then became a Bhikkhuni later on. So, I mean, one conclusion is that, well, if these things, Dombrich's response to this criticism is to say, well, this is the example of it. You know, you're criticizing me because you're saying there's no example of it. Well, here's the example. Yeah. So obviously it has a major shift in the understanding of Indian history. It's perhaps not implausible that this kind of practice should be found in a Buddhist text where they're concerned to critique it rather than to be found in the actual Hindu texts themselves. And we could understand that within those texts they would be more inclined to keep it as one of the hidden or esoteric traditions, so it wouldn't actually make it into the public sphere. So whether it's Shiva as such is another question, but these kind of general kind of practices. What other conclusions does he make? It is, yeah. Personally, I find it quite persuasive. But the early text, and it does seem, the Pali does seem to me mostly, you know, representing the early text reasonably well, doesn't really determine the matter one way or another. So, it's definitely open for interpretation. I mean, again, I think that one of the problems with these critiques of Gombrich's idea is, I think there's a number of problems. One problem is that they don't explain the problems that he was addressing. So they merely say, well, you know, your explanation doesn't work, but actually Gombrich has started out and worked through his whole essay showing all the inconsistencies in the account and saying, well, actually the traditional accounts don't agree with each other. And even within the Pali tradition, there's several different versions of events which are all incompatible and all have their own implausibility. So, and the Buddha's myth kind of adopts the motifs of the hero mythology but completely purifies everything. And takes all the violence out of it. Oh, look, and it's still very real. It's still very real. When I was in Malaysia at my mum's house, my mum's place was broken into while they were away. And they had a maid who would come and just clean up and so on, I think once a week or whatever while they were there, and they had a guard who would sit outside the house, and the guard wasn't allowed inside the house. But they had a new guard, and this guard was known as a, what do they call him? A bomo, they call him in Malay, which is a like a witch doctor or black magic practitioner. And he had this kind of reputation, and so the maid, of course, was very scared of him. And so one day there appeared these eggshells around the house, and the maid was like terrified, you know. And when I mentioned this to some of my Malaysian friends, they're like, "Oh, the eggshells! Oh, when you see them, that's when you know you've got to be really scared." And it's like magic. I'm not sure specifically how they use it, but that was the thing. Black magic. I never found out why or the detail, but that's what they say. Anyway, so he ended up intimidating her so much that he actually got into the safe and nicked all the jewellery and money and stuff like that. And they found the stuff in his house, some of it in his house, and some of it the hop shop guy had identified him as selling it, and he still denies that he stole the stuff. Oh, I just found it. So. But anyway, I mean, this, you know, definitely this is very powerful force to the land. So, okay, so he's given the going forth by the Ehi Bhikkhu formula. Throw away his weapons. According to the individual translations, when the Buddha allowed him to go forth, Angulimala's hair and beard magically disappeared. A miracle also recorded in the Pali commentary. Kota Agama and the accounts record that after granting Angulimala's request for ordination, the Buddha spoke a verse of encouragement which caused Angulimala to reach stream entry. According to the two Samyukta Agama versions, he became an arahant and then concluded with a set of verses spoken by him. So two individual translations similarly record his attainment of full awakening at this point, while the Pali and Ekotra Agama versions turn to the same at a later point of their narration. So as usual, the moment or the actual attainment that somebody has being a matter of strong disagreement among the tradition. Okay, so moving back to the text. Now, on that occasion, great crowds of people were gathering at the gates of King Pasenadi's inner palace, very loud and noisy, crying, "Sire! The bandit Angulimala is in your realm. He is murderous, bloody-handed, given to blows and violence, merciless to living beings. Villages, towns, and districts have been laid waste by him. He is constantly murdering people, and he wears their fingers as a garland. The king must put him down." And as we've seen this motif found earlier in some of the other verses. Then in the middle of the day, King Pasenadi of Kosala drove out from Savatthi with a cavalry of 500 men and set out for the park. He drove thus as far as the road was passable for carriages, dismounted, and went on foot to pay respects to the Blessed One. The Buddha said to him, "What is it, great king? Is King Seni of Bimbisara of Magadha attacking you, or the Lichavis of Vesali, or other hostile kings?" And Seni replies, "Venerable sir, King Seni is not, Bimbisara is not attacking me, nor are the Lichavis, nor are other hostile kings, but there is a bandit, Angulimala, who's laying waste to villages, towns, and districts. I shall never be able to put him down." King Pasenadi, not particularly known for his sort of resolute courage as a king. We've now reached our limit on Google Pages. We're missing out page 313 and 314, so sorry about that. We've got to revert to the Stone Ages. Actual paper text. Okay. Then the Buddha replied, "Great king, suppose you were to see that Angulimala had shaved off his hair and beard, put on the yellow robe and gone forth from the home life into homelessness, that he was abstaining from killing living beings, from taking what is not given and from false speech.
that he was eating only one meal a day and was celibate, virtuous, of good character. If you were to see him thus, how would you treat him? Venerable sir, we would pay homage to him, or rise up for him, or invite him to be seated. We would invite him to accept robes, arms, suit, a resting place, or medicinal requisites. Or we would arrange for him lawful guarding, defense, and protection. But venerable sir, how could such an immoral man, one of evil character, ever have such virtue and restraint? Now on that occasion, the venerable Angulimala was sitting not far from the Blessed One. The Blessed One extended his right arm and said to King Pasenadi, "Great King, this is Angulimala." Then King Pasenadi was frightened, alarmed, and terrified. Yeah, all the Loma Hunter's hairs standing up all over his body. He went over to Angulimala and said, knowing this, Blessed One said to him, "Do not be afraid, great king, do not be afraid. Ma bhai maharaja ma bhai. Nati te ito bhayanti. There's nothing fearful for you here." Then the king's fear, alarm, and terror subsided. He went over to Venerable Angulimala and said, "Venerable sir, is the noble lord really Angulimala?" "Yes, great king." "Venerable sir, what family is the noble lord's father, and what family is his mother?" My father is a Gagga, great king, and my mother is a Mantani." "Then let the noble lord Gagga Mantani Putta rest content. I shall provide robes, arms, food, resting place, and medicinal requisites for the noble lord Gagga Mantani Putta." Now at that time, the Venerable Angulimala was a forest dweller, a arms food eater, a refuse rag wearer, and restricted himself to three robes. He replied, "Enough, great king, my three robes are complete." So these, of course, being some of the main Dutanga practices, is forest dwellers, Araniko, Pindapatiko, one who lived only on the arms food. That means that he would, for example, not accept invitations to eat in people's houses, as the Buddha did from time to time, but it would only accept what he took on the arms round. And so Kuliko only wore the robes that were taken from charnel grounds or other kind of places where rags were left. And Te Divariko means he only had the three basic robes and didn't use any extra cloth requisites. Yeah, that's right. Pansakula is just the finding whatever cloth is left lying around. And Te Diva is the three robes. Oh, it's Ewan. Oh, well, there you go. These classes do have some benefit after all. Yes. Okay. Where are we at? Okay. Now, at that time, the Venerable... Oh, okay. King Pasenadi then returned to the Blessed One and said, "It is marvelous how the Blessed One tames the untamed, brings peace to the unpeaceful, and leads to those to Nibbana who have not attained Nibbana. Venerable sir, we ourselves could not tame him with force and weapons, and yet the Blessed One has tamed him without force or weapons. Now, venerable sir, we're busy and have much to do, and so I will go." "So go at your convenience, great king." Yasadani Maharaja Kalam Manasi. Is that formula still, because the standard formula in the suttas, it's still used in some formal situations when people are dismissed, for example, at Botnanachat, after the all-night meditation every week, when the lay people sort of formally announce, they have a formula for announcing that they're giving up the eight precepts and going back home and so on, and then the Ajahn replies with this particular formula, "Now is the time to do what you see fit." Now, then when it was morning, Venerable Angulimala, dressed and taking his bowl and outer robe, he went into Savatthi for alms. So this isn't necessarily like the next morning or anything. This is just another sort of standard section which has been inserted here. Could be any amount of time. Went into Savatthi. As he was wandering for alms from house to house in Savatthi, he saw a certain woman in difficult labor, in painful labor. When he saw this, he thought, "How beings are afflicted, indeed, how beings are afflicted." Kilesanti vata bhosatta, kilesanti vata bhosatta. When he wandered for alms in Savatthi, he returned to the Blessed One and told the Buddha about this. And the Buddha said to him, in that case, Angulimala, go to where that woman was in Savatthi and say to her, sister, since I've been born, I do not recall that I have ever intentionally deprived a living being of life. By this truth, may you be well and may your infant be well. Then Angulimala said, Venerable Sir, wouldn't I be telling a deliberate lie, for I have intentionally deprived many living beings of life? Okay, in that case, said the Buddha, Angulimala, go to Savatthi and say to that woman, since I was born with the noble birth, I do not recall that I've ever intentionally deprived a living being of life. By this truth, may you be well and may your infant be well. Okay, so here's the appearance of the famous Angulimala Paritta, which is still chanted as a chant for childbirth in the Pali tradition. Yatoham bhagini ariyaya jati ajato nabhi jana misantitupanam jivda voro peta tena satyena sotita potu sotigam hasa. This is an example of what they call an asseveration of the truth. And this is felt to have a power in the Indian tradition, that if you declare something to be a truth, and particularly like a painful truth or some kind of difficult truth, then it has an efficacious power, like a magical power. And this is a trope of Indian stories, which is used in some quite entertaining words. So, for example, there's one example, time of King Ashoka, where for some reason a prostitute has to make an asseveration of truth. And her asseveration of truth was, whatever man that comes to see me, whether he's rich or poor or whatever caste he's from or handsome or ugly, then I don't distinguish between him. I treat him in exactly the same way. And that's her asseveration of truth, and then that's what gives her the power to make these things. So it's quite interesting ways it's used. And there's another one, it's a very funny Jataka story about that, where there's a whole family and a rishi, and they all have to make this asseveration of truth. I can't quite remember why. And they all make these very kind of funny and revealing ones. And like the monk says, well, I just have to admit I've been really unhappy as a monk the whole time, and you know, it's just been, I haven't found any satisfaction of being a monk for 20 years, and it's just been real hassle the whole time. And then the husband says, I can't remember what they all say now, but the husband basically says, well, I've just got to admit, I don't really love my wife, and, you know, I just have to put up with this marriage for the sake of it. And the wife says her one. They're all saying these kind of brutally honest asseverations of truth, which of course then has a very kind of very powerful positive effect in the outcome of the story. Yeah, it's a really nice start. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Exactly, yeah. Sorry? Oh, we have to try. But the interesting thing is that in most of the stories, it's not just a banal kind of truth. You know, it has to be a really powerful truth. Yeah. Uh-huh. Oh, what's his one again? Yeah. Interesting, isn't it? Because the Buddha's thing, Buddha's change in it, saying he's born in the noble birth. Okay, so since he became an Arya, and then he's not deliberately harmed a living being. Well, it's certainly got this kind of riddling aspect to it as well, doesn't it? It's a bit like the kind of the whole stop thing, you know? You've stopped and you haven't stopped, you know? So it's repeat. Yeah. Exactly. Okay. And so then, after that happened, then before long, dwelling alone, withdrawn, diligent, ardent, and resolute, Angulimala became an arahant. And a stock passage of attaining arahantship here, and as we heard that some of the versions put that earlier. And after he became an arahant, then he went for alms again, went into Salvative alms. On that occasion, somebody threw a clod and hit the Venerable Angulimala's body, someone else threw a stick, and someone threw a potsherd and hit his body. Then with blood running from his cut head, with his bowl broken and his outer robe torn, remembering bowls are often made of clay, Angulimala went to the Blessed One. The Blessed One saw him coming in the distance and said, "Bear it, Brahman, bear it, Brahman." Or, as you might say, more idiomatically, "Deal with it, Brahman." Just deal with it, alright? Using the word Brahman here in the spiritual sense, Buddhist spiritual sense, as a term for arahantship. You are experiencing here and now the result of deeds because of which you might have been tortured in hell for many years, many thousands of years, and many hundreds of thousands of years. Oh, sorry, many thousands, many hundreds, many thousands. Yeah. Right. Exactly, yeah. It does, yeah, definitely. You know, you get a few thousand years for committing multiple serial killings. It's not so disproportionate. Sometimes time and result appears, yeah. So the commentarial explanation of this, any volitional action, any karma, is capable of yielding three kinds of result. A result to be experienced here and now, i.e. in the same life as which the deed is committed, a result to be experienced in the next existence, and a result to be experienced in any life subsequent to the next, as long as one's sojourn in samsara continues. Because he detained arahantship, Angulimala had escaped the latter two types of result, but not first, since even arahants are susceptible to experiencing the present life results of actions they performed before attaining arahantship. Now, this being a slightly controversial matter, to what extent there are a couple of passages in the Anguttara that seem to imply or suggest that the Narahat has to experience all of their karma, and even if in a very diluted sense, before they die. But yeah, it does. Yeah. Oh yeah, absolutely. Okay, so just to come back to have a brief look at the comparative study, the Kali and Akutra Agama versions and two individual translations record several additional events. One of these events begins with King Pasenadi, who on his way to catch Angulimala paid a visit to the Buddha. The Akutra Agama version and one of the individual translations indicate that he'd come in order to get the Buddha's advice on how to best undertake his mission. Pali commentary explains that Pasenadi was too afraid to set out straight away to catch Angulimala, which would definitely be in line with Pasenadi's character. According to the commentary of Goss, Pasenadi wanted to report the matter to the Buddha in order to find out if he was going to be victorious. If the Buddha warned him that the brigand would defeat him, Pasenadi would have a good reason for not setting out on the mission. According to the Chinese Udana Varga account, however, King Pasenadi had heard that the thief he wanted to catch had in the meantime become a monk. So he'd heard a rumor about this, so the Pasenadi wanted to go and ask the Buddha about it. Pali and Akotara Agama versions and the individual translations describe in similar terms that the Buddha told King Pasenadi that the robber he wanted to catch had become a monk and was sitting close by, and the king got afraid. Okay, once Sandy had overcome his fear, he asked the to offer the requisites to Angulimala,
And only the Pali version has the idea that, that Angulimala refused because of his ascetic practices. Pali and Ekotra Agama versions and the individual translations conclude their narrative of this event by reporting King Pasenadi's admiration for the abilities, Buddha's ability to tame Angulimala. Okay, so, and then the Pali and Angulimala and the Ekotra Agama versions and the two individual translations describe the encounter with the pregnant woman in similar terms. One of them has the woman asking Angulimala for relief from her difficulties, and in the Chinese Udana Warga has a variation that it wasn't a woman but an elephant in labour. According to the Pali version, when Angulimala told the Buddha what he'd seen, the latter instructed him to declare in front of the woman that since his birth and so on, as we've seen, a couple of the versions say that Angulimala's found it difficult going on alms round because the people had a bit of a negative reaction to seeing him, which is fairly understandable. Now the Pali Vinaya reports that the going forth of Angulimala had caused such an uproar among the people as to cause the Buddha to promulgate a rule against ordaining a robber who wears an emblem. The rationale of this rule might be that while the Buddha's decision to ordain Angulimala was based on his insight into the latter's potential, other monks might not have such knowledge. In view of the repercussions such an ordination might cause among the laity, it may have seemed better to prevent other monks from imitating the Buddha's action. Dajabadho Choro. Analia is trying to rationalize, but there does seem to be a bit of a conflict here that we have the going forth of Angulimala, and yet there's a rule against giving the going forth to robbers. Possibly the connection of these two stories was a later development. The robber who wears an emblem, I'm not entirely sure what that means, but I think, if I remember rightly, it's usually explained as basically someone who's had a wanted notice put up for them. So basically somebody who's wanted by the king. So that being the Dajha Badho Chora. It doesn't actually say wearing an emblem. It actually says flag, bound, feet, whatever that means. It's the same word. He is described as Chora Angulimala. It pretty much just means bandit. Yeah. There is a conflict here, and there's certain ambiguities among the Vinayas themselves on this question of whether it's okay to ordain somebody who has been a thief or something like that. Yeah. And in a sense, it's fair enough that the Buddha would know that it's an exceptional circumstance and that things like that might happen earlier on in the dispensation, but then later on, if it becomes generalized, then it maybe becomes an issue. And it's pretty understandable. There's probably a lot of other robbers around who are looking at it and thinking, right, he got out of it, and so they're looking to get ordained. So, yeah, implausible. Hard to say. It's not clear what time frame in the Buddha's dispensation it was, but fairly likely. Yeah. Prisons. Oh yeah. Well, this seems to be the thing that once someone's ordained, in the sense they did have a legal immunity in some way. There's another case, for example, when King's talking to the Buddha's talking to Ajatasattu. Someone in Palasutra and says, well, what happened if like one of your slaves had gone forth? And he said the same thing, that he'd gone off in the requisites and so on and so forth. So there seems to be a sense in which the ordination, in a sense, is like a sanctuary. So it removes you from you're being subject to the secular law. Yeah, this is the phrase that we've just had here, the dhajabhaja chora, yeah. Yeah. So, yeah, that's, you know, so obviously it was an issue. Yeah. So they come and get the...
You see that like an individual case like that might be okay, and if the Sanhedrin's got the trust of the Buddha and so on, then it'd be regarded as all right. But if it became a general thing, the authorities would get pretty annoyed. So, okay, so then we move on to the Angulimala's verses. So these verses are also found in full in the Theragata, and some of the verses also found independently in the Dhammapada. Angulimala was alone in retreat, experiencing the bliss of deliverance, he uttered this exclamation. Those who once did live in negligence and then is negligent no more, he illuminates this world like the moon freed from a cloud. Who checks the evil deeds he did by doing wholesome deeds instead, he illuminates this world like the moon freed from a cloud. The youthful bhikkhu, who devotes his efforts to the Buddha's teaching, he illuminates this world like the moon freed from a cloud. Let my enemies hear discourse on the Dhamma, let them be devoted to the Buddha's teachings. Let my enemies wait on those good people who lead others to accept the Dhamma. Let my enemies give ear from time to time and hear the Dhamma of those who preach forbearance, of those who speak as well in praise of kindness, and let them follow up with kind deeds, for surely then they would not wish to harm me, nor would they think of harming other beings. So those who would protect all frail or strong, let them attain the all-surpassing peace. Conduit makers guide the water, fletchers straighten out the arrow shaft, carpenters straighten out the timber, but wise men seek to tame themselves. Being one of the most famous verses in the Dhammapada. There are some that came with beatings, some with goads, and some with whips, but I was tamed by such a one who has no rod or any weapon. Harmless is the name I bear, though I was dangerous in the past. The name I bear today is true, I hurt no living being at all. So the name harmless is Ahimsaka, and him being known, that being one of the words, names that he's called in some of the different versions of it. Though I once lived as a bandit known to all as Finger Garland, one whom the great flood swept along, I went for refuge to the Buddha. Though once I was bloody-handed with the name of Finger Garland, see the refuge I've found, the bond of being has been cut. While I did many deeds that lead to rebirth in the evil realms, yet their result has reached me now, and so I eat free from debt. They are fools and have no sense who give themselves to negligence, but those of wisdom guard diligence and treat it as their greatest good. Do not give way to negligence nor seek delight in sensual pleasures, but meditate with diligence so as to reach the perfect bliss. So welcome to that choice of mine, and let it stand. It was not ill-made. Of all the teachings resorted to, I have come to the very best. So welcome to that choice of mine, and let it stand. It was not ill-made. I have attained the triple knowledge and done all that the Buddha teaches. And I'll note some of the parallels here with the different versions of the Dhammapada, occurrences of the verses. Anolio just makes a couple of textual notes which relate to the point that we made before. The Pali version continues with verses in which Angulimala expresses his wish that his enemies might hear the Dhamma and develop patience, as then they would not wish to harm him. The same recurs in the Samyukta Agama version, according to which Angulimala moreover highlighted his practice of patience towards those who feel resentment towards him. This is noteworthy, since even though the Samyukta Agama version did not narrate his experience of being attacked while begging alms, the way the verse is formulated points to an accident of this kind. The Akotara Agama version and the individual translations in contrast record the story of Angulimala being attacked while begging, but do not have such a verse. Hence the fact that the Sanghuta Agama versions do not report certain events found in the Pali and other Chinese versions does not necessarily undermine the originality of these tales. So you see the point that Anala is making here, that we seem to have sort of reference certain bits of the story are found in different sections, and though even though one version maybe doesn't have
one part of the story, but still it has some certain references that appear to presuppose the existence of that part, even though it's not actually mentioned in that particular version. Perhaps the Buddhist school from which the Samyutta Agama collection stems had these stories as a separate discourse, or even in their respective commentary. It's a characteristic of the Samyutta Agama versions that most of their presentation is in verse. And the reason for that is because remember I said at the beginning it says it's found in the two of the Samyutta Agama versions. And the second or shorter Samyutta Agama is mostly the Sagatha Wagga, the chapter with verses. And so that's where this is found, and no doubt it would be in the Bhikkhu Wagga, a chapter dealing with various monks. And so this is why the presentation is mostly in verse. He's not saying here that the Samyutta Agama as such is mostly in verse, and that's characteristic of Samyutta Agama as a whole. It's just the fact that it occurs within the Sagatha Wagga section of it. This suggests that their presentation to be comparable to the Angulimala Theragatha. The Theragatha also refers to several events from Angulimala's life only implicitly without giving a full account. Such a full account is found only in its commentary or else in the Angulimala Sutta. In fact, the agreement between the Pali account and the Akotara Agama account version, which appears to belong to the Mahasangika tradition, and that's just a hypothesis, suggests the episodes reported by both versions to go back to a time preceding the arising of the different Buddhist schools. The Angulimala Sutta continues with two verses that compare abilities in various crafts to the wise who tame themselves, followed by indicating that Angulimala had been tamed without external force. Similar verses can be found in the Samyutta Agama and Ekotra Agama versions and the individual translations, and so on and so forth. That's interesting. After the verses, the Ekotra Agama and one of the individual translations continue by reporting that the Buddha declared Angulimala to be foremost in quickly developing knowledge. So that's interesting. In the Pali tradition, that's...
Who is that in Pali tradition? You don't know that. Foremost in swiftness of direct knowledge. Dante. He's not known outside. He's the one that the Buddha taught. In the seen will be only the seen, in the heard will be only the heard, in the cognized. Yeah, it is. Anyway, it's not Angulimala.
Not very well. Maybe Kipabinya. The nun who's in that case is Bhadra Kundalakesa in Nepali. And according to the Ekotara Agama version, the Buddha continued by narrating a former life of Angulimala at the time of Buddha Kassapa, explaining that those who in his present life had become his victims had killed him in that former life. Again, this being a somewhat later conception of the notion of karma, more the notion of karma as fate. Well, I guess he had lots of former lives. Or they all gained up on him? I don't know. Maybe you have to read the particular one. Oh, dear. Ekotara Agama, the number of victims is 80,000. P119 says he killed and harmed innumerable hundreds of thousands of living beings. Well, I mean, that would be an interesting development from the kind of the religious idea, if he's representing that religious culture. Okay, so, and then some final remarks by Venerable Analia here, looking back on the different versions of the Angulimala Sutta, a point to be kept in mind is that this discourse is not in its entirety spoken by the Buddha, in fact only very short fragments of it are, but rather is an extended narration with relatively few parts that purport to be direct speech by the Buddha. From the perspective of oral transmission, the Angulimala would thus be closer inclined to the narrative material found usually in the commentaries. It is in fact particularly noticeable how several episodes and motifs found in the Pali commentary recur in the Ekotara Agama discourse and the two individual translations. The somewhat commentarial character of major parts of the present discourses, together with the fascinating contrast between the bloody-handed brigand Angulimala and the Arahant monk Angulimala, may account for the differences found between the various versions and the recurring tendency to exaggerate aspects of the narration. Found in nearly all versions, despite all variations, the central message of this discourse remains the same, in that it highlights the potential of the Buddha's teaching to transform even abominable criminal by diligent practice and self-control into a saint. And so
very good summary there by Analio it's interesting that with all the variations and the complexities and the details, the basic message of it still is very clear in all of the versions that we have. And just to note that this particular feature where episodes are found in the Pali commentaries but are included within the canonical texts of other schools is a fairly reasonably common thing. And it does seem to be that the Pali tradition tended to, and it's by no means a hard and fast rule, but tended to be more conservative in including material. And so you find this in the Vinaya and other places that material in the Pali is found in the commentary, whereas in the other schools it's found in the actual canonical text. Okay, let's finish by paying respects.
Bhagavata.